Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast in which we discuss the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films of all time. Before you go any further, be warned. What you're about to hear is riddled with spoilers. We suggest you watch the movie before listening to this podcast.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Welcome again to the Top 100 Project with another AFI movie. Before we get going on to this week's film, we're going to do last week's trivia question about this week's film, which was ruined by Robert Osborne.
Yes.
At the beginning of the TCM presentation that we watched. But here it is anyway. Harold Russell made his acting debut in this film and then only appeared in two more theatrical movies. How many years passed between The Best Years of Our Lives and his next project, and what was that film?
How many years? I think the next movie came out in 1980, mm-hmm. so that would be a 34-year gap.
Correct.
And, oh gosh, now I've forgotten what it's called. It's something moves, lost moves, or...
You're halfway there.
Latest moves, or...
Inside moves.
Inside moves!
Directed by Richard Donner.
Mm-hmm. I have never heard of it before, and now the only thing I know about it is that Harold Russell is in it.
He is. Anyway, the Top 100 Project's 33rd movie is The Best Years of Our Lives. William Wyler's second AFI film was 37th on the 1998 Top 100 list, between Midnight Cowboy and the brilliant picture we reviewed last week, Double Indemnity, and stayed right there at number 37 in 2007, between Manly Man Flicks, The Bridge on the River Kwai, and The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which is coming up in 2 weeks. Best Years premiered on November 21st, 1946, then came out for everybody to peruse on Christmas Day in 1946, and it was a huge hit for RKO and MGM. Bev will read us the skinny on Best Years.
Three World War II veterans, Frederick March, Dana Andrews, and Harold Russell, return home and struggle to reacclimate to society. Al Stevenson, played by March, is a banker with a drinking problem. Fred Derry, played by Andrews, is a soda jerk in an unhappy marriage. And Homer Parrish, played by Russell, has lost both his hands and feels unworthy of his girlfriend.
Or in a nutshell, Heartland war vets only find modicum of happiness in local watering hole. They only seem to be happy when they're soused.
Yep.
Which is probably true for a lot of World War II vets or any kind of mm-hmm. vets. And with that, we probably won't make too many wisecracks in this one because it's a pretty serious subject matter and a pretty intense film about that subject matter. But what did you think of this film?
I have somewhat mixed feelings about it. I really enjoyed it. It was a good film with some really great, great scenes. It was too long, in my opinion.
Yeah, okay.
There are storylines that don't belong there and they stick out and they kind of get in the way of what the movie does best, which is get inside the heads of these men and really show you what it's like to come home from war with the real pitfalls of coming home after something like that. You know, you would think after seeing, say, a movie like All Quiet on the Western Front that going home would be the prize for these soldiers, but it was far, far more complicated than that. And it shows this really great nuanced story, or I should say stories, about what these men went through and their different circumstances. But then there was this extra story of the love triangle between the character of Fred, his wife, Marie, and one of the other vets' daughters, Peggy. It felt superfluous. The women were total caricatures of a terrible, heinous, greedy, you know, hussy wife. Well, and
one character was that.
Yes, and the other character is this canonized saint, you know. The only thing she ever does wrong is fall in love with Fred. Everything else she does is completely perfect. She's beautiful, she's gentle, she's kind, she's smart.
She wants to break up his marriage. That's
she wants to break
honorable.
Up his marriage. That's the one thing that she does that's bad. But of course, without that, the story couldn't happen. Why she falls in love with Fred at all is never really addressed. Like, they just kind of leave the audience in the dark to why this perfect catch would want to break up the marriage of a PTSD suffering, crappy job having war vet. It doesn't really make sense.
The first time she meets him, he's a drunk, and then they take him home because he can't get into his wife's building at that point. Mm-hmm. And so he doesn't mean to. He's drunk and he's half asleep, but he sort of molests her in the process.
Yeah.
Well, not a great start for their romance.
No, even though he's married, even though, you know, any gentleman wouldn't behave like that. And then I think it's because she's comforting him because he's having, like, night terrors.
Yeah.
It's not like he's a terrible character. He's not. He's not somebody who's unworthy of love, but it's a little hard to believe that this girl is boring. She's so perfect. There really isn't. It's kind of a little unrealistic, actually. Not just her, but her mother, Millie, is also just, her patience is unrealistic. The amount that she puts up with and the strength that she kind of has, even though her husband, though he's charming, is drunk and risking his job over and over again, she just seems to kind of cope with everything. She copes with everything perfectly. She copes with her daughter trying to break up a marriage perfectly. The same would go for Wilma. She seems to have no character at all, except that she loves Homer and is willing to be patient while he works out his emotional response to losing both his hands.
Well, Myrna Loy plays the wife, Millie, plays Frederick Marsh, his wife, so we should make that more clear. I agree that she is not given a chance to play much of a character. Now, she was Nora in the Thin Man series.
Mm-hmm.
Great role for her, legendary role. This is her only AFI film, as it is for Marsh, his only AFI film. Marsh was a terrific character actor who won a couple of Academy Awards, including for this film, and played famous roles like Jean Valjean, Willie Loman, and Dr. Jekyll, but this was his only AFI film as well, so the two of them are getting this one chance. And Dana Andrews is also in his only AFI film. He'd been in The Oxbow Incident a few years before this, which I love. Good movie with Henry Fonda. And Laura, which is a pretty famous movie from a few years before.
Yeah,
and he worked into the 80s. He worked a long time. It's interesting, though, of the three men, he is the main character and probably has the most screen time. It's fairly evenly divided. But because he has a story with his wife and he has a storyline with Teresa Wright's character, who plays Peggy, he probably has the most screen time. Kind of like Travolta in Pulp Fiction, that they're sort of equally divided, Travolta.
Because he takes part in more than one storyline.
Yeah, exactly why. And yet he's the most, I wouldn't say uninteresting, but because post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, we know what that means, has become a common thing in our modern society with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and veterans coming home and they're just mentally so messed up. We knew about it in Vietnam. It wasn't called that then. I don't know that people really addressed it in World War II. It's almost like, well, we won and you got through it, so let's move on.
They called it shell shock, right?
Shell
and
shock,
it started
right.
in World War I. That's coming home from World War I.
But I don't think people gave
night
it...
terrors
people didn't give it the same kind of attention and they didn't seem to respect
somebody
who came home with their body still intact could be this messed up.
Yeah.
The three different men have three distinct characteristics
of
a war veteran. Each of them have one of them. One's a drunk, we said that. That's March. One has the PTSD and can't seem to get over that. They all have PTSD, but it's really apparent
in
Andrews. Yeah. And then Russell has no hands, so he's the one that has a physical disability, even though many people who come back from war have all three of those.
Yeah.
They drink because they're either in physical pain or mental pain or both. But that's one thing about the movie I thought was interesting, because the men are so emotionally vulnerable, which has not been a common thread for us so far on the project, that men would be this vulnerable. I mean, we've seen men be the main characters of stories, so they have to have some vulnerability.
Yeah, part of the reason I can even complain about how dull the female characters are is because these men have so much depth to the writing and their performance, and like you say, they're really, all three of them are quite sensitive in the best kind of way.
Yeah.
And it's really refreshing to see. It's not like manly war heroism. It's a different kind of heroism. It's a different kind of bravery and kind of a different kind of strength to come home and readjust to a life that should be familiar but is completely different now that they've seen and done what they've seen and done.
I think the first 25 or 30 minutes is as good a filmmaking as we've seen in the entire project so far. And I'm including Citizen Kane. I'm including Gone with the Wind, Casablanca, all the ones we've seen so far. The first 30 minutes, as good as any of that, I think. And maybe the reason why is the first little while in the film is just those three guys.
Just them going home and their mounting anxiety about going to see their families.
Yep. And they want to, but as soon as they get close, it's like, well, let's go have a drink. No, you're here. We're letting you off in this cab right now. No, let's have a drink.
Yeah.
And by the end of the night, they all end up at that bar anyway, and they all get soused, which is my nutshell was all about that.
They compare going home to going to war. They say it feels exactly the same as they're flying over the part of of America where they're from, where they're going home to, which is Boone City. It's a stand-in for Cincinnati, Ohio. So, like you already said, just kind of like Midwest generic America. But even as they're flying over that part of the world, then they're talking about the anxiety they feel and how it feels the same as when they left.
Did you have the same thought that I had, that Millie and Al, were they happy before the war? They've been married for 20 years. They have these two kids, you're both teenagers. But were they happy to begin with? Homeland, the TV show Homeland, does this as well as anything I've ever seen. At least the first season does. with the great dad's home. That's wonderful. But yeah. We got used to him not being here. So now what?
Yeah, yeah. And this movie actually addresses that really nicely. Mm-hmm. He comes home. The kids are pretty much grown up. They are self-sufficient. They don't need him anymore. They are used to him not being around. Like, it's almost a burden to them to have to get used to this new person being around the house. But that's a good question, if they were happy before. She's really genuinely happy to see him. She, like I said before, she's a perfect wife.
Oh, by the way, that scene when he comes home and he doesn't let the kids say anything so he can surprise her by seeing him, that was on the AFI show, that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it was highlighted by, I think it's Dreyfuss, Richard Dreyfuss talks about that. And it's an emotional moment, as it's supposed to
be.
And it's funny how the two scenes that I remember them showing in that special were that one and where Harold Russell gets mad at his younger sister when she and the other young kids are kind of laughing and giggling at him. I don't think they mean to be mean, especially the sister.
They're trying to, like, sneak a look at his hands through the window.
And so he smashes the windows and take a look. And then the poor girl apologizes instantly. She doesn't mean to make him feel bad. And those two moments really got to me, even though I knew they were coming. I've said before, though, that's what happens with me with movies. It's knowing they're coming more often than that initial shock of it. But when Al comes home and sees his wife, that is a pretty powerful moment. But it's later that night when they're all sitting around and he's giving gifts to his son, really badly played.
A terrible
actor. When Michael Hall, who plays Al's son, is out of the movie, it's kind of a pleasure.
He really does just leave. Like you mentioned, by the end of the movie, there's a wedding scene where everybody's families are there, but for some reason, Rob didn't make
it. He's long gone.
He's so terrible, the scene where he comes home and he's giving him a samurai sword and a Japanese flag that was like, I mean, it's a little bit grotesque, but it's a souvenir of a soldier that he killed in battle. And his son is so blasé. I'm sorry. Do you know one single teenage boy in the universe that wouldn't be thrilled to get a samurai sword? Come on!
Yeah.
And his reaction, he's such a bad actor. Thanks for the samurai sword, Dad. Hey, go now. It's the worst. But that's a bad scene, but you were talking about the scene where he comes home.
But within that scene, where he's giving the gifts to the son, what's notable about that, and yes, he's talking to the son at that moment, but Millie, the wife's in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, shouldn't he be kind of fawning over all three of them? And maybe he wasn't like that before he left. But it almost seems like he's avoiding her, and she's avoiding him.
There's definite awkwardness,
There's the element of the, and we said Homeland does that really well. I think that that's the best thing Homeland has done. Yeah. It's a TV show, I don't want to dwell on it too much. But when Damian Lewis meets up with his family, that's some great stuff in there, because the kids, much like in this movie, the kids would have grown several years. And in the Homeland case, it's many, many years, actually.
Yeah.
But how do you re-relate to these people? But with your kids, it's your blood. You know, people have always said, if you want to get a tattoo, don't get a tattoo of your girlfriend. Maybe not of your wife, because that maybe won't work out. But with your kids, they're always going to be your kids.
Yeah, you know, it's a
And maybe Al has the same kind of deep down thing with this. It's, I love my wife. I've been with her for 2 decades, but I don't really know her anymore.
Well, when he's talking to Fred in the plane, it's like, oh, man, I've been married for 20 years. And the way he delivers that line, you get the impression that it's been a long 20 years. They straight up admit that they had marital problems when they're talking to Peggy.
That's right. That's
later
true,
on. Yeah. Like, so it's not really that ambiguous, but it's hard to imagine when you see their relationship as it is there that they had any major problems. They're dealing with major life problems, but they seem to be coping with it pretty well as a couple, dealing with him having problems with his job, him having problems with his drinking. But they seem to be very much a team throughout.
Well, yeah, but Millie's big moment in the movie, and this has been pointed out by a few people who reviewed it, would be the scene where Al speaks at a conference of other bankers, and he has a moment where he says, we should be making sure that all young GIs are taken care of when they come back from the war. And he gets applause for that, as he should. But before he stands up to speak, you see Millie counting the drinks with her fork, cutting into the napkin.
Yeah.
Which is a little over the top, but she never confronts him about any of this, but she's obviously making note of it, and you can't really blame her. But then it's one of those things too. It's hard to blame somebody who's come back from that kind of situation for doing whatever it takes, short of murder or committing crimes, for how they deal with it. And we know more about this now because of the horrible things that people see with modern warfare. Not to say that World War II warfare was any beach, but it's truly an example of something that you and I and most people we know cannot relate to.
Absolutely.
So how you deal with that, short of doing bad things to other people, may not really be our business. Although, obviously, a wife has a right to criticize and complain about her life being affected by this, too.
That speech is good, but I have to complain about the setup in that scene. I understand that they did it to kind of create the blocking for the shot where they wanted to have Al's boss and Millie in the same shot.
Yeah.
But they put Al's boss right in between them.
It was strange, yeah.
It's so obvious. Like, you can't watch that scene and not be distracted by this really ridiculous seating plan. Who would ever seat a husband and wife apart from one another like that?
That was odd.
It's so strange. And then it called so much attention to itself that it ruined the specialness of the shot and the deep focus.
Right. Ray Collins from Citizen Kane, in his second AFI film,
mm-hmm.
plays the boss. You just mentioned deep focus.
I was just going to say, Greg Toland.
Getting to Greg Toland.
Yep.
Another film from Mr. Greg.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he had four AFI films. This is Toland's last of four AFI films after Wuthering Heights, also with William Wyler.
Mm-hmm.
And The Grapes of Wrath for Ford and Citizen Kane, of course, we know that, for Wells. Toland died less than 2 years after this movie was completed.
No kidding.
Which is why he never worked with Wells again, because I often wondered that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why.
He was really a rather legendary cinematographer. Mm-hmm. He invented a technique that...
He's still shooting those ceilings, and he's still using deep focus.
Did he invent that technique?
I don't know if he invented it, but he certainly perfected it.
He perfected the technique of deep focus.
And he used it.
And this film uses it a great deal. There's not a lot of cuts. There's a lot of scenes that play out in wide shots where you can see all the action take place.
When Al comes home, Millie's in the background in the kitchen, and she's in focus. The shot that people talk about the most, I guess, when it comes to deep focus and the best years of our lives would be when Fred has to break up with Peggy.
Oh, yes.
At Al's behest. And Al and Homer are in the foreground with Homer's uncle, who's played by Hoagy Carmichael really well. Mm-hmm. I liked him a lot, actually.
I did too.
He was very smooth for a non-actor. He was very, very good for a non-actor, actually.
I didn't know he wasn't an actor.
Mm. He was also in To Have and Have Not with Bogey and Bacall and some other films. That was his first one. But
he was a musician, I presume,
Yeah, he was a pianist. Yeah. But anyway, in that scene, Fred's in the background. They never cut to him. We never see him up close. But in deep focus, you see him on the phone, and we have to imagine what he's saying.
You see Al turn his head and look, and, you know, he's distracted by what's going on in the background.
Yeah. So that's Toland at work yet again. We know he was brilliant. We've seen him so often. Unfortunately, we won't talk about him again, except in retrospect.
Yeah, to discuss his influence.
But we've talked about him a lot the last couple of months on the project. Okay, well, back to the theme of coming home, which is what they call the movie in 1978. About the very same subject, coming home from Vietnam, though. And that was John Voight, Jane Fonda, and Bruce Dern. Hal Ashby directed. Very fine film.
Not on the list. No. Yeah, but a well-regarded film.
Mm-hmm. Came out the same year as The Deer Hunter, which is about the exact same topic as what we're on. That is an AFI film. You mentioned before we started recording about Forrest Gump has elements of that. With Gary Sinise's character, Lieutenant Dan, has to deal with some of these same things. And many non-AFI films have dealt with it so well.
As I understand, they all owe a debt to this movie. This was a subject that wasn't really covered in Hollywood films. And this film was coming off the back of the dozens of pro-war propaganda,
Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Well, exactly, like Yankee Doodle Dandy. Even Casablanca, to some extent.
Neither of those shows a single soldier actually doing anything about... actually fighting.
That's a good point. But there were lots of war movies made at the time that were positive, that were trying to, you know, keep people's spirits up and encourage men to enlist.
Major directors like Frank Capra and I believe John Huston, and maybe even Wyler, but those other two at least, went overseas to shoot propaganda-type films.
But to address the consequences of people coming back, I don't think... I mean, this obviously wasn't the first film to do it. All Quiet on the Western Front deals with this a little bit. But... it was an enormously popular film, and it probably did a great deal for the genre of the coming home film.
Born on the 4th of July is another example that's very similar to this in many major ways, and one of Tom Cruise's best performances, without a doubt. The one I kept thinking about during the movie, and it's the worst of all of them from a technical standpoint, I would say, and certainly from a talent and acting standpoint and a writing standpoint, and that would be the Rambo series.
Oh, okay.
Because I've seen them all, including the newest one that was out a few years ago, and they're not good films. They really aren't. And Stallone...
First Blood is a good movie. It's not a great movie. It's a good movie.
It's acceptable, maybe. Stallone could be a good actor, but the movie's got to be just kind of what it was, really, was the 80s. We're going to win this time. Because what he's doing is fighting the commies.
Yeah.
But one thing I loved about those movies when I saw First Blood again for the second time a few years ago was what it started with is that Rambo is trying to go home.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want to do this anymore. But then, on the other hand, that's all he was ever good at.
Yes.
Which is also what
another
post-war film in a very small way would be Riggs and Lethal Weapon. He even has a line to Murtaugh. It's all I was ever good at is war and killing people. Rambo's got the same problem, but Rambo's trying to be a normal person, and he gets stopped from that by
kind of
jerks.
Sucked back in, yeah.
Yeah, it's not really his fault at all that what happens in that movie happens in First Blood. And the whole series becomes kind of about that anyway. So I don't like the Rambo movies, but I think they owe a debt to the best years of our lives.
Sure, yeah. And you hit on it, a great deal of what Best Years of Our Lives talks about, especially with the character of Fred, is back in America, he was poor. He was low class. He was a soda jerk. He didn't really have a lot of prospects in life.
Yeah.
But when he went to war, he was an exceptional soldier. He was very brave. He got promoted. He became an officer. He outranked Al, who back in America is a banker. He's by far his superior in just about every single way. But over there in at war, he was the hero. He was competent. Over he was there, the leader.
Say that word. Anyway.
Sorry. And that probably was an appeal of a lot of lower class people who did enlist, that they would have an opportunity. It really is a meritocracy.
That's a theme in Platoon.
Oh, yeah, that's
I just watched Platoon. I bought the Blu-ray for us when we get to the film in a few years for the project. And then I'll watch it now. And yeah, early on in the film, they have conversations about that very thing.
Yeah, so you have this person who's incredibly valuable to a country under these very specific circumstances.
But otherwise, to hell with him.
But otherwise, to hell with him. You know, when he comes home, there really isn't anything for him. And not only, it's almost worse because they gave him that moment of glory. And when they gave him that moment of glory, it was in exchange for an enormous risk to his life. You know, a lot of men did what he did and didn't come home. And they gave up much more than even Homer did with his hands. You know, a lot of men lost their lives in that war. He risked his life for that, and they still came home to just go back to being a soda jerk, to have all that glory essentially stripped away from him. People care, but they're really just paying lip service. He can't even get a job because he's competing with all the other GIs who are returning. And that theme is played out really beautifully. And one of my favorite scenes of the film is near the end when he's leaving town because his marriage has ended. His love affair with Peggy is not going to happen. And he's just heartbroken. He's lost his job. Nothing has worked out for this guy. So he's just going to get a plane to anywhere. He doesn't even care. Just the first plane that's leaving. But as he's waiting for that plane, he's wandering around what is essentially a graveyard of all these old bomb planes.
Which is what he did. He was a bomb sighter, I guess you call it. He would sit in the front of a bomber and spot the
and he was
targets.
He was evidently very good at it. And so he sees all these planes and they're not useful anymore. So they're just basically lined up to become scrap. And
although, trivia question number one.
Okay.
What was that scrap going towards? What were they going to build?
They were going to build houses.
There you go. So at least something useful was coming out of this.
Yeah, that's actually kind of a positive thing. And it winds up being a very positive thing because when the foreman finds him in one of the planes, reminiscing about that time in his life which was both traumatic, but also the only time when he was a useful person who felt competent and valued, they have kind of an argument that ends with him giving him a job, which is a much better job than being a soda jerk, a job that you can tell he's going to be far more suited to, and there his future starts to develop, and there finally some optimism.
And what is he doing? And the movie doesn't hit this on the head the way I'm going to right now, but he's building something.
Yeah, he's creating something. And that's a useful thing, you know, it's a good thing to do to build houses.
That's the reason why America got to be as great as it did
after
the war.
Well, that's just it. That's the type of job where you can feel like you're contributing to the world, which is what he really needs more than anything, more than money, more than love. He needs to feel
a purpose in life. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I don't want to harp on America being this horrible place too much because we do certainly have admiration for the country. And back in these days, especially, they had come out of the war. They had won the war. They had done the right thing by Europe and Asia. But there's also an element in this movie, and obviously in Vietnam, and obviously in the modern era too, where it's the what have you done for me lately?
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that there was even such complicated feelings among Americans about the war, but whether they belong there. Like, history looks back on it not only as a perfectly just war, but also, like, Americans were the big heroes that once they joined the war, they turned the tide and they made sure that Hitler wasn't going to gain any more ground, and it wasn't very long before he was eliminated, the Nazis were eliminated altogether. Like, history views their involvement as a completely uncomplicated, heroic, good thing
with
to
credit
do.
To the Russians and us, the Canadians,
oh,
and the Brits,
of course,
and many other
but
great
we were
countries.
Already in the war. I'm talking about like the controversy of whether America should have joined the war or not before Pearl Harbor. That was, you know, a contentious debate among Americans of whether they belonged in the World War.
It probably still was because this movie was released just shy of 5 years after Pearl Harbor.
When you compare World War II to just about every other conflict America's ever been in, it's got to be the least controversial. But yet there still was controversy. It's a little surprising to learn that, but I guess at the time there was.
Now, we mentioned that Frederick March won Best Actor for this film.
Mm-hmm.
And this was his second win. He is an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly subtle. That's his burden in life, and it doesn't look like he's necessarily getting better at the end of the movie. But it's not the theme of the movie. It's just a character trait he has.
Mm-hmm.
The previous year's Best Actor Oscar winner and the Best Picture winner also was about an alcoholic. That was the story, The Lost Weekend, where Milan plays the character in The Lost Weekend, where he's an alcoholic who's obsessed with drinking, and that's what the whole movie is about. And I looked through to see how many other times an actor won. I just looked at Best Actor and looked at the other three categories. And these are the ones that stood out the most. Lee Marvin and Cat Ballou, Robert Duvall and Tender Mercies, Nicolas Cage and Leaving Las Vegas, and most recently Jeff Bridges and Crazy Heart all played alcoholics in their roles. Now, I guess what my point is that the Academy just loves an alcoholic, because there's an awful lot of nominees, too.
They like overcoming adversity, and I think alcoholism is kind of seen as a character flaw that people can overcome, and they do. Yeah, it's true. They do reward that a lot. I'm sure if you look at every year's nominations, there's probably at least one nominee in every year who's playing an alcoholic. The most recently I can think of in 2012 would have been Denzel Washington in Flight.
Yeah.
That's the whole movie is really about his substance abuse problem. Hollywood does love that.
First time he's been recognized by the Academy since Training Day.
Oh,
so you're talking over 10 years, and what did it take him playing somebody who was an addict to coke and to alcohol? Yeah. I said we wouldn't make too many wisecracks in this podcast because of the subject matter being so serious, but I do have a few I want to make now. First one is, we need to bring back the word swell. That's just swell. They use it a lot. That's swell, Dad. Actually, it's not even the kid saying it to the father. It's the grown-up saying it to each other. Also, responsible banking.
Oh, my God,
is this
right?
1946 or an alien planet?
Okay, so Al goes to his job where he's expected to determine which GIs are worthy of this, like, GI Bill loan program. And he gets in trouble because he's giving it to people with no collateral who don't have, like, enough credit.
A war vet in the specific case
see. Yeah. And he has, like, that conflict with his boss about... How about, you can't just give someone a loan if you're not sure they're going to pay it back. You have to be more careful, more careful, more careful. And that's, like, the big conflict he has with his boss. It's just so surreal.
The boss is following
that.
The rules so stringently.
Yeah.
Maybe a little cruel about it, but it God, we'd honor that now, more so.
Complete opposite now. Now it would be, you'd be punished for not giving somebody a loan, even if they were, like, if they just got out of prison.
Because with what they were doing in 2008, and maybe are again, that was the point. So you can bet against them.
Yeah, exactly. You want to give bad loans. It's so funny to see that.
The last thing I'll say on the wisecrack front is, don't discuss politics with a war vet because you might get your legs punched out.
Well, don't be a jerk would be the lesson of that scene.
That guy in the scene where he's getting on Homer about how you got a bum rap and you got no hands and it wasn't even fair how they treated you. He didn't handle it very well, but I agree with what he was saying. I mean, maybe not so much for World War II, but certainly the modern wars where someone could be in a bar and someone like Homer with no hands and be told that they were screwed and if they're still patriotic, and apparently most veterans are, they still believe in the cause.
If you're going to endure what these guys endured, then of course you're going to want to continue to believe that you were doing it for a just cause. I mean, to think that this happened to World War II vets, imagine what it must have been like
Vietnam vets. That character, the jerk character in the soda shop, was ahead of his time.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't necessarily wrong, and it's certainly his opinion. He doesn't handle it very well. He certainly doesn't show respect to Dana Andrews or Harold Russell in that scene. But anyway, that's my point, is that he's supposed to be a bad guy, but I think he's got a point.
While we're talking about Harold Russell, the character of Homer, he was my favorite thing in the movie. As the movie started, I was immediately struck by, and I hate to say this, but he's not a great actor. It's really noticeable. He's struggling with his line readings. You can see how he's clumsy about blocking, and there's something kind of mechanical about his movements. And you know, it wasn't for lack of opportunity. Wyler was notorious for taking dozens of takes, so I'm sure he had all the chances to get it right. He just really was inexperienced, and he really wasn't great at it. But somehow, still, over the course of the movie, he has this beautiful, authentic way about him, this sweetness and this sensitivity, and his character and the way that he portrayed it, even clumsy at times, it didn't matter. He just comes across with so much warmth and pathos. Like, I don't think since The Tramp have we seen a movie in this project where there's a character that's just so lovable as Homer is. And you really have to give credit to Harold Russell for that. I mean, maybe he was really like that in life. Maybe he wasn't. But the character and the way he portrayed it, to me, was what made the film. And as I've been thinking about it in the days since we saw it, he's what I keep coming back to. He's what I keep thinking about.
I think that's true for a lot of people. Harold Russell, not the character, but the actual guy, is a great example of a phrase I normally don't like, and that's otherwise abled. Because somebody who's lost some limbs, he's only lost his hands, it's bad, but it's not the same thing as losing, as he points out, a lot of the guys lost all the way up to their entire arm or something. He still has his elbows.
His elbows, yeah.
But he's really good with those hooks.
He really, really is.
And it's been
is.
About a year since it happened. It's supposed to have been about a year since it happened to the character as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's terrible he doesn't have his hands anymore, but he's actually very skilled at most things they show him doing in the movie. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times they're showing those scenes of him doing mundane things, probably in some way to show off, hey, look how good this guy is at this. This actual person is, look how good he is at doing this stuff.
Is there a scene that, like, there was not a scene in the movie that grabbed my heart more than when those kids are kind of staring at him through the window and the first thing he does is go for the doorknob and he just can't because he's impatient and rushing and clumsy. He just cannot turn the doorknob and his frustration with that is what leads him to just shove both his hooks through the glass and break the glass. Oh, that moment is just heartbreaking.
And it's his sister that is the one that's kind of the wrath of his, you want to take a look? Come take a better look at this.
Yeah, because he's struggling, but he through his struggles, he's so optimistic and positive, even when it's ugly, you know, even when he's really suffering, his attitude, it just, it really stays with you. It's a really beautiful, beautiful part of the film.
And he, of course, gets married at the end of the film to Wilma. Kathy O'Donnell is the actress who plays Wilma. This was the movie where she got the introducing credit. I don't think she did a whole lot of things after this film that were all that noteworthy, but she plays it effectively. The scene they have towards the end in the bedroom where she sees what he really has, like physically can see when the hooks are off that he just has stumps. Earlier, we see his father undress him for bed, and as I don't want to be wrong about this, but I don't think we see his arms without the hooks on
them. You don't.
Okay, there you go.
He's wearing a shirt. They shoot it in such a way that you never see his arms without the hooks.
Except at the end with Wilma.
Yeah.
So not only is it the first time that she's seen him that way, but it's the first time that we have too.
And his speech during that scene when he talks about all the things that he can't do, he can't put his hooks back on, which means he can't open the door, he can't smoke a cigarette, you know, he can't do anything without calling somebody for help like a baby, as he puts it. Your heart just breaks for him.
Yeah.
It's really well done. It's such a great part.
I have a trivia question for that.
All right.
The infamous Harold Russell and his hands. So were Homer's hands chopped off, burned off, or shot off?
Oh, that's easy because they say it like a dozen times. They were burned off. Yeah, he says it over and over.
All right. I knew it was a couple.
Here's a trivia question for you. How did Harold Russell actually lose his hands?
I don't know that.
He was filming a training video and handling a bomb to show people how to handle it. And the fuse was malfunctioned.
Oh, God.
And it went off in his hands and he lost his hands.
Yikes.
I know, so it wasn't even in battle.
Neither was the character.
Yeah, that's right.
Way of losing his hands. Both of them were not even about...
He was a mechanic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, again, like a mechanic losing his hands, if you can imagine the tragedy of that. And I have to point this out because, as a Canadian, I am legally obligated to point out that he was a Canadian.
He was a Canadian.
He was born in Nova Scotia, which is where your father's family is from. Yeah. His family moved to Massachusetts when he was 19, and he enlisted for war the day after the Pearl Harbor attack.
Many men would have been in the same boat. He only ever acted in 3 movies. We mentioned one of them already, Inside Moves. He wasn't an actor, and he stayed away from the business for most of his career.
As he said himself, there's not a lot of parts for guys with no hands.
Sure. And Russell's performance was rewarded not once, but twice. He won for Best Supporting Actor, and March won Best Actor, as we said. But he also won an honorary award for inspiring the vets by acting in this movie, by showing that he can still live a fairly normal life.
Yeah, they were so sure that he wasn't going to win,
probably
because he isn't a great actor, that they came up with that award because they just wanted to award him somehow. And he made history again in the 90s for being the first person to sell his Oscar. He auctioned off one of them, I think it was the supporting actor Oscar, not the honorary Oscar, for $60,000 to pay for his wife's medical treatments.
What a shame.
Yeah, he caused some controversy. And apparently after 1950, they started making winners sign an agreement that they could not sell it.
Okay.
But because he won it before that, they couldn't do anything about it.
I know that Spielberg has bought at least one Oscar from auction and paid a pretty penny. I believe it was Clark Gable's for It Happened One Night because he wanted to give it back to the Academy. He paid whatever they charged for it, which I believe was a lot of money, and said, here you go. He just has that much respect for the Academy, I guess.
Well, he also has that much money. No matter how much money is, I think it has to be a lot before Steven Spielberg notices that.
No, I know, but I'm saying that's a certain honor in that to not just have these things floating out there when they mean so much to the people in the business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've focused on them maybe a little bit too much, but it is the AFI and Oscars really do go hand in hand in a lot of ways. One of the big ways, if I didn't say this on a previous podcast, I will now. Every truly American film that won an Oscar for Best Picture was nominated for the original list. Hamlet wasn't. The movie that came in 1948, same year as Treasure of the Sierra Madre, because mm-hmm. it wasn't American.
Mm.
And neither was, I think, it's Tom Jones. But everything that could have been nominated, if it's American, was in there. And there's some really terrible Best Picture winners in the history mm-hmm. of the business. But the AFI paid them at least enough respect to say, okay, we'll get it in there as a 400 nominee, but not necessarily as a top 100.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, the second list, a lot of Best Picture winners that made it the first time were knocked off. And we're going to cover them, some of them pretty soon. And American in Paris is one of them. But anyway, they are linked for mm-hmm. sure. I don't want to focus too much on the Oscars because this is the AFI.
Well, before we stop talking about them, let's talk about how many the movie won. It set records, didn't it?
Well, it won 7, and then the honorary one for Russell, so that's 8 in total. But it won Best Picture, Best Director for Wyler, Best Actor for March, Supporting Actor for Russell. The screenplay won. That was written by Robert Sherwood, who also wrote Rebecca for Hitchcock.
Mm.
And he adapted the McKinley-Cantor book. And the movie also won for Best Editing and Music. And now here's something that you've said before. How does a movie that's nearly 3 hours win for Best Editing?
And I was waiting for you to finish talking so I could say this. I'm an editor, and let me tell you, no movie that's 3 hours long deserves a Best Editing Oscar, period.
Samuel Goldwyn also won the Irving Thalberg Award that year, which was kind of a yearly thing back then. They almost always awarded it mm-hmm. to somebody every year. And it was essentially the Best Picture producer, because back then, I don't know how it worked specifically, but it wasn't that if you produced a movie, you now the way it is, and for many years, it's been if you're the producer, if you're one of the three or four producers, then you go up and you accept the award.
Yeah.
But back then, it wasn't quite as simple as that. So that's, I think, why they give the Thalberg out so often. Now it's more once every 5, 6, 8 years that you win a Thalberg, and it's not necessarily associated with a movie of that year. And while we're on this, let's quickly do the other list, because there's only two other things to mention. Not surprisingly, Best Years of Our Lives is on the National Film Registry for 1989, the inaugural year. And the only other AFI list it made was, it was 11th in the top 100 Cheers. Very inspiring. Just missed the top 10.
Yeah.
That seems very appropriate, I'd say.
I know you're not the biggest fan of this movie, but how do you feel about its placement on the list? Oh,
I think it's definitely a fine film. It definitely deserves to be on both lists. Mm-hmm. It should be somewhere in the, maybe the 50s or 60s. I don't think it should be 37th, but then I'm also biased because a lot of my favorite films are on the list, but they're nowhere near this ranking. And as we've said before, it's one of only three films that did not move from one list to another mm-hmm. as far as where it was ranked. 37th is not a bad spot for it, though, and I think that's reasonable enough, but what about you?
Well, melodrama is really not my genre, so I struggle with it a little bit in that manner, but like I said, I may not have enjoyed the experience of watching it that much, but as the days have gone on, it's really stayed with me, and certain scenes have, in retrospect, made this gigantic impression on me, so I can see how over the years it'll just gain in esteem, and I don't think I'd put it at 37 either, but I'm still glad it's on the list. I hope that that gets people to see it, because it's certainly a movie worth watching.
William Wyler has 3 AFIers. The next one is Ben-Hur. We're a little ways away from that. Also a Best Picture winner, and also a major winner, and also a major hit. But up next on the Top 100 Project, right in the teeth of the joyous holiday season, is a Christmas classic about greed, theft, and suicidal depression. It's a Wonderful Life. One of my very favorite films.
Yeah.
That'll be a long podcast.
This is going to be a fun one.
There will be a few impressions of Jimmy Stewart.
I'm not promising they're not going to be a ton of impressions.
They may not be funny, but they'll be in there. So, a coming attractions trivia question for It's a Wonderful Life. I thought about this for a while. There's 100 things you could say about this movie. But here's the one I came up with, and it's actually a two-parter. Who acts as the unofficial master of ceremonies during the Let's All Give George Money scene at the end of the movie? And the bonus question is, describe at least 2 of the things people say to George as they drop money on the table.
Well, that may be easy for people. It's a really famous scene.
You better see the movie to know it. Well, when we do it next week, you will have seen the movie just a few days before.
Yeah.
And you'll probably remember the second part. The first part, you'll obviously know when we see the movie if you can't think of it now.
There's plenty of things I know about this movie just from listening to you incessantly quote it all the time, so
I may have an advantage.
Frequently quoted? Is that better?
Oh, before we wrap, I gotta say this one more note I meant to say when we talked about March winning the Oscar. He's very good in this film, and I have no problem with him winning, except that Stewart has a much more complicated role and a much more major role in Wonderful Life the same year, and I think he should have won.
And we will talk about that next week. And in the meantime, if you would like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to reach us, shoot us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. I think that would be swell.
Swell.
And cut.